Thank you, Nida. Okay, so today I will talk about a problem which is somewhat unusual for Math Finance in that it concerns hedge funds, which are not one of our traditional topics. Let me start with a word of background to put this in perspective. Hans Vollmer yesterday talked about the remarks of Lord Turner of the FSA, which were not very kind for the use of mathematics in finance. In fact, we have seen similar things going on in the US. For example, this article by Krugman in the New York Times magazine, where he says that economics went astray because economists mistook beauty clad in impressive looking mathematics for truth. Okay, so this is not a direct attack, but is not very far from that. It goes on and it says that economics got in trouble because it got seduced by a perfect frictionless market, which is usually what we study, right? So fortunately, we did not have to respond to that, okay? Someone else did, because in that article there were a number of attacks, you know, on some colleagues. So Cochrane said that no, we don't have enough math, and it's good to hear this from a non-mathematician, okay? And it goes on talking about frictions. It says that they are bloody hard with the math we have today. Okay, so without entering the debate between these two important guys, we understand that this is something we have to go after, okay? Making frictions stack. It's on his website. I don't think it's published anywhere. But if you just Google it, you will find it immediately. So my talk today is just one small step in trying to make frictions tractable in a very specific setting. Okay? So if you have questions, of course, go ahead as we go along. You don't have to wait for the end, with Nizar's consent, of course. So the problem of high watermarks is essentially what is the effect of the performance fees on the behavior of hedge fund managers, okay? So I will show you the model, which is based on power utility, which is, you know, the bread and butter of optimal portfolio choice. So we are not doing anything fancy from the preference point of view. And I will show you the solution, which is based on the concept of effective risk aversion, and it has also relation to drawdown constraints. And then I will discuss what happens when you change the fees to expected utility of welfare, if you prefer. And we will discuss equilibrium in between the investor and the manager. So what are high watermarks anyway? So the hedge fund managers are paid with a two-tier scheme. There are two components in their fees. One are the regular fees, which are typically a fraction of the fund's asset. And then there are performance fees, which are typical of hedge funds. You don't see this in mutual funds. So the regular fees are like 2% of the fund's asset, and are paid periodically, like every month or so. So we can imagine they are paid continuously. It's not a bad approximation. The performance fees are a large, very large fraction, typically 20% of the increase on the fund. Okay? So these are the two components of a hedge fund manager's pay. The high watermarks simply say that before the hedge fund manager can get more fees, he has to reach a new maximum. Okay? So if you lose and then you gain, you have to recover your losses before you get more fees. So in practice, suppose you have, you know, three periods. The hedge fund manager starts at 100. Suppose he makes $10. It takes 20% of the increase, that is $2. Okay. Next period, suppose he loses. So the fund becomes 100 from 108. He doesn't get anything from the performance fees perspective. Next time, it makes a lot of money, okay? It gets more fees, but only on the increase from the previous max. So this is what the high water mark entails. And this is the picture that you see when you look at the high water mark problem. So the blue line here is the fund value. The red line is the high water mark, which is a fancy name for the earning maximum. And the yellow line is the cumulative amount of fees that the hedge fund manager is getting out of the performance fees. Here, for simplicity, I'm neglecting the regular fees just because I want to explain how the regular performance fees work. Okay. So this is the game, more or less, that the hedge fund manager is playing. So the question, of course, is what is the effect of this strange path-dependent contract, okay, which has prevailed in the industry regardless of any theoretical justification. So the folklore on high water mark is that the manager is getting a share of the profits, but not a share of the losses. So it's like he has an option. And if you have an option, typically you want to increase the volatility to maximize its value, right? So this is doesn't really mean anything, but it's an argument. Okay? Now, of course, the argument has its flaws because it's based on a static intuition and also on a complete market intuition. There are many objections. First of all, the manager here has multiple call options, if you want to look at these as options, because you know, it's not a one-period problem, it's a continuous time in this case. And second, the strikes of these options, if you want to call them this way, depend on the past actions. So if you take too much risk, maybe the future options will be out of the money, so there's no reason why, in principle, more risk is always better. Finally, you cannot really hedge this option because otherwise you will have to short your fund, and fund managers typically cannot short their funds. Okay, so this intuition basically is nonsense. Okay, as common as it may be. So, summing up, which questions we want to answer? What is the effect of fees on risk aversion? If you have more fees, does it make you more, less risk averse? Which way does it go? Second, expected utility. What happens to expected utility if you increase or you decrease fees? Third, these high watermarks, are they consistent with any investor's objective? I mean, why are they there in the first place? Okay, so there is some work on this topic of high watermarks, not much, but there are a couple of papers. This seminar paper of Goetzmann, Ingersoll, and Ross, they simply ask the question, what is the value of the high watermark contract? They take basically the Black-Scholes equation in a risk-neutral setting, and they find that the high watermark contract could be worth anywhere between 10 and 20% of the fund, so it's important in terms of the value of for the manager, according to their estimates. Okay. Then there's another paper. Goetzmann, Ingersoll, and Ross do not solve the portfolio choice problem. They just assume that the fund evolves like geometric Brownian motion. Panagiotis and Westerfield, they do solve the portfolio choice problem, but they assume that the manager is risk neutral. Okay. So has no risk aversion. The surprising part of the result is that they show that even if the manager is risk neutral, the optimal strategy is not to increase leverage without bound, which is what the normal Merton investor would do if he's risk neutral. It is to keep a constant fraction invested in the fund, and this result essentially contradicts the option pricing intuition that I presented before. Okay. There are two important assumptions in the result. One is that the fees cannot be invested in the fund, can only be invested in the risk-free rate. And this is done in order to prevent the manager from hedging the high watermark understood as an option. And second, that the horizon is more or less infinite in the model. Okay? So this is more or less the state of the art. They also discuss some extension to HindI-1 utility, but I will not go there here. So what do we do is to introduce risk aversion. This is one ingredient. The other ingredient is that we do not consider only performance fees, we introduce also the regular fees, okay? The previous literature only considered performance fees without regular fees. So the main result is this, that the optimal portfolio is again constant, okay? It's a Merton-like portfolio. The difference is that you don't use the true risk aversion of the manager as optimal portfolio, you use the effective risk aversion, which is a convex combination of the true risk aversion of the manager and the value of one, okay? Which corresponds to logarithmic utility. So this result tells you that the effect of fees is ambiguous in terms of increasing or decreasing risk aversion. If the manager is less risk averse than logarithmic utility, the fees will make him less risk averse, because the fees always shrink to one, the risk aversion, right? But if the manager is more risk averse than log utility, which is, you know, the more typical case, then the fees will actually decrease the risk aversion, because again, they shrink it to one. So this is, in a nutshell, what we are doing, the main result. And the rest of the talk will be in explaining why we get here and how we do it. So the bottom line is that these performance fees make the manager not necessarily more risk averse or less risk averse, they make it more myopic, where by myopic we understand logarithmic utility. Okay? And the second observation is that in this formula, you see the alpha, the performance fees, but you don't see the phi, which are the regular fees. So even if you introduce the regular fees in the model, they don't show up in the optimal strategy under some mild parametric restriction I will show you later, which holds for all practical values. Okay? So another corollary of what we're doing is the following: if you have a power utility, long horizon, and no regular fees this time, there is an equivalence between three problems. One problem is the original one, you have the manager optimizing power utility from fees at a long horizon. The second problem is an investor who maximizes utility not from the fees, but from wealth, but with another risk aversion, which is the effective risk aversion. And this is just a rephrasing of the main result before. The third problem is the maximum drawdown constraint, which says that the same portfolio is optimal for an investor who maximizes the utility from wealth, has risk aversion gamma equals to the true risk aversion of the manager, but has a constraint on the drawdown of which must be less than 1 minus alpha. So if you are a manager with 20% performance fees, you will behave as an investor with a constraint on not having more than 80% loss of your earning maximum. Okay? The last part of the equivalence comes from comparing our solution to the solution of Grossman and Zhu and Cvetanic and Karatas of the problem of optimal investment with drawdown constraints. Okay? So it's just a corollary. It's not an additional result. Okay? So the same optimal portfolio is shared by these three problems. Okay, so if you had to leave, the result is over. Okay? Now I will explain how the result comes about. So the model is very simple. We take a manager who can invest in two assets. One is the risk-free rate, the other is the geometric Brownian motion with you know, excess return mu. Here, the budget constraint is slightly modified from the usual one because we have to deduct fees. So this is the regular fee, and this is the performance fee. This alpha divided by 1 minus alpha simply says that if you split any gain of $1 into two parts, alpha for the manager, 1 minus alpha for the investor, the fee that is deducted will be alpha divided by 1 minus alpha times the net increase in the fund, okay? Because the net increase in the fund is itself 1 minus alpha times the gross increase, okay? So what you deduct from the fund, of course, you have to add to the fees, and the fees are compounded at the risk-free rate R. So the third line here reflects the fact that the manager cannot reinvest in the fund on his own account. And this is just a definition of Ernie Max. Okay? So this is the model. So the first observation is that the model a priori does not necessarily make sense, right? Because the fund value X is defined only implicitly. Yes, David. The investor cannot do anything. No, he invests only at the risk-free rate. These are the fees that he's making at delta T from the regular fees and the performance fees. Yeah. He cannot do anything with the fees that he's earning. So, I mean, I have no sympathy for this assumption. The only reason why we make it is that we want to be consistent with the literature. It is probably questionable. So at any rate, here there is this technical issue. You have to find X explicitly, and well, at least you have to prove that it exists. Okay. It turns out that you can find it explicitly in terms of a hypothetical fund from which there are no performance fees deducted, okay? So the result is this, that XT, the fund value after the fees, is equal to the exponential of RT minus alpha, the running maximum of RT, where RT is simply the log return on the fund under the same strategy, but without deducting the fees, okay? So this is not hard to show. It basically comes from this lemma, which is a one-liner. If you have this sort of functional equation, you can solve it explicitly like this, and this is just an observation, which comes from the fact that the soup of the soup is the soup. Okay, so at least we know that the fund exists, which is refreshing. Okay, so what is our objective? So here, of course, you want to make the problem tractable. This was the initial motivation, okay? So to make the problem tractable, you have to remove some of the difficulties. Here, the difficulties are that there is a natural state variable in the problem. The natural state variable is the ratio between the current value of the fund and the high water mark, okay, which is a number oscillating between 0 and 1. It's a reflected diffusion, essentially. And you know that when you have an optimal investment problem with a state variable, you have a double dependence on not only the state variable, but also the horizon. So difficulties come two at a time. They don't come one at a time. So you have to kill one of them to solve the problem. And the way we do it is that we take the limit of a long horizon. In other words, we consider this the optimal strategy for this objective here, which is also called risk-sensitive control. One of the advantages of taking this objective is that the objective also has a clear economic interpretation in terms of certainty equivalent rate. So this lambda, which will be the maximum of this objective, can be understood as the retirement rate, essentially. If suppose you want to convince the manager to retire, you can tell him, look, if you retire, I will let you invest your money at this risk-free rate lambda. And if lambda well, let's say L. And if this L that you offer is above this lambda, you will accept to retire. Otherwise, you will not accept to retire. Okay? So this is understood. This has the dimension of race free rate. Okay. So in the case of the Merton problem, this is just the risk-free rate plus one-half the squared Sharp ratio divided by the risk aversion. So we're not doing anything special here. Okay, so let me just give you the heuristics for guessing the solution. I mean, verifying it is another story. Suppose for a second that you have no regular fees and no interest rate. Okay. In this case, the cumulative fees are just proportional to the increase in the running maximum. Okay. It's the picture that I showed at the beginning. In this case, maximizing the certain equivalent rate of the fees is the same as maximizing the certain equivalent rate of the running maximum itself. Right? Okay. So if you write formally the evolution of the value function, you end up with one term, which is the usual term of the Merton problem, and with this singular term, which is the essence of the problem at hand. If you try to solve the finite horizon problem with the expected power utility from horizon capital T, this is what you would end up dealing with in terms of the AGB equation. Of course, you take care of homogeneity and you kill one dimension. You still you're still left with two dimensions. One is the time and the other is the state variable measured by the ratio between the fund and the high water mark. Okay? So you have this nonlinear equation, which is an ODE, right, yeah, it's a PDE here. And has this Neumann condition, and it also has these two terminal conditions. Now, this is of course very ugly, and there's no explicit solution for this problem, so that's why we take the Langrand approximation. At the practical level, if you want the Langrand approximation, what you're doing is basically forgetting about the terminal condition. This is your heuristics, of course. And you guess a solution of this type where W is a function of the state variable itself. And now you have to guess the growth rate beta. Okay. So you have this AGB equation, which is now ODE with some unknown parameter beta, and this boundary condition. So if you try, yes, go ahead. Yeah. Yeah, this is what Panagias and Westerfield do. No, you can do it, but there is no risk aversion if you do that, right? You maximize the present value of the fees under the original probability P discounted at some subjective rate beta, let's say. Yeah, this is what they do in their paper. But the disadvantage of solving this problem is that you obtain a constant portfolio which depends on many things, which include the discount rate beta, the Sharpe ratio, the liquidation rate that they consider, but it does not depend on one thing, the performance fees. So you obtain a manager who, paying him 10%, 20% or 1%, continues to do the same thing, which is doesn't sound right to me, but it's a result. So anyway, if we continue to solve this problem, what happens is that for each beta you get an upper bound on the certain equivalent rate lambda, and essentially you want to choose the beta that achieves the lowest upper bound, and then you have some hope that this the maximum. So here there is a little miracle which occurs, okay? This ODE has many solutions. For each beta that you pick, in the allowable range. Here you will get a solution satisfying this initial condition up to multiplication by a constant, of course. The simplest solution of power type, this is the only solution of power type, is the height one. Okay. Now, of course, this is just nonsense. You have to prove that this is really the case. Okay. So, this is the verification theorem. The verification theorem says that whichever portfolio pi, which is chosen among those that are integrable and admissible, then you have a certain equivalent height which is less than or equal than this object here, which is the maximum between this formula for the certain equivalent height and the risk-free height. In fact, the interesting case is only when this is attained and this is not attained. And if you choose pi to be the portfolio which I showed you at the beginning, then you get exactly this rate. Okay? And you need this non-degeneracy condition here if you want the uniqueness of the solution. Basically, this non-degeneracy condition here ensures that this maximum is equal to the non-trivial formula as opposed to the risk-free rate itself, because when the certain equivalent rate is the risk-free rate itself, basically any portfolio will lead to the same risk-free rate as a certain equivalent rate, and that's not a very interesting condition. You see also that here there is another parameter restriction, which says that essentially the fees minus the safe rate should not be too big compared to the squared trap ratio. These are all important restrictions. If you fail any of these, the verification theorem doesn't go through. We conjecture that they are also sharp, but we don't have a proof for the sharpness. We are happy at least that for all typical parameter values, these restrictions seem to be satisfied for reasonable levels of risk aversion. Okay? More on this later. So to prove this, you don't need any AJB equations. You just use a Martingale argument. Of course, the difficult part is proving that this inequality is satisfied for any strategy, proving that when you plug this constant, then the equality is satisfied is essentially an exercise in the asymptotics of the joint law between Brownian motion and its maximum. Okay, so it's nasty but conceptually trivial. Okay, so I will show you the idea more or less of how the upper bound is proved. Here, of course, you are always bothered between by the distinction between p positive, in which case the utility is bounded from below, and p negative when it's bounded from above. So I will show you just one case, the other is the same, with all the inequalities flipped. So you take RT, remember RT is the log of the fund without the fees, okay? And you write it as follows. You write it as Brownian motion with drift. Okay, here I'm using W tilde, which is the risk neutral Brownian motion. Okay, so I have taken the dependence on mu, which was here originally, and I have W tilde swallow it. So now, because of the explicit formula for the fund value, here there is a typo, this should be X star. Sorry about that. Then this expected value of the power of the maximum is equal to this object. Okay, this comes from the initial explicit solution. And at this point you're dealing with a maximum of essentially Brownian motion with drift with some time change. Okay. So this is not, it's not clear what this will do. So you change the measure and you go under the risk neutral measure to calculate the expected utility, which is something we usually don't do, but we do in this case. Okay. Of course, now you have a non-Nicodym derivative here. Now you want to separate these two parts, this one from this one. Why? Because now under this measure Q, this R has become a local matrix. Sorry, the exponential of RT is a local matrix. And the supremum of a local martingale intuitively cannot go anywhere. Okay, if you take the supremum of a Brownian motion with drift, it can do all sorts of things. But the supremum of a martingale basically can grow only like square root of t. The idea is this, okay? So this is why you go under Q. So now, for any delta that you wish, you can use all this inequality to divide these two terms, from one from the other. The second term is, of course, very easy. It's just the exponential moment of a Gaussian. So you just calculate it. Don't worry about it. Now you have to deal with this guy. Okay. So how do you deal with this? You know that this is a strictly positive, continuous local martingale, and you know that it goes to zero as t goes to plus infinity. Okay? Now, the good news is that essentially, there is just one type of such continuous local martingale up to a time change, and that's exponential Brownian motion without drift. Okay? So, with the drift in the exponential, so it becomes a local martingale. So, if you take the lifetime supremum, it has an inverse uniform distribution, regardless of pi. Okay? And this is where the where you get rid of the arbitrariness of the strategy. Of course, you're not interested in the lifetime supremum. You're interested in the supremum after time capital T, but this is certainly less than that. Okay? So now you can just estimate this with the lifetime supremum, and you can calculate this explicitly because this is just the integral of a power, and the integral of a power is less than infinity only if the power is less than 1, sorry, minus 1. Okay? So now you have a bound, which is non-trivial, only when delta is such that this quantity is finite. So for any delta which is in this range, you have this bound. Now you let delta approach the bound, and you get exactly the result that we had conjectured with the AJB argument. Okay? So this is essentially the proof in the case where phi is equal to 0 and r is equal to 0. And you can do this in two slides. Of course, most of the paper consists in extending this when r is greater than 0 and phi is greater than 0. In which case it becomes a little nightmare. You have to separate a lot of stuff. And but eventually you get there. Okay? But I will not show you. Either you believe me or you read the paper. Sorry about that. So I mark on the drawdowns. As I said, the comparison with the drawdown constraint problem comes simply from the comparison of our optimal solution to the solution of Grossmann and Zhu and Chvitan and Karatas. But you can still give some heuristic argument to show why this is happening, that this is not a coincidence. Okay? So imagine for a second that there is a single account which contains both the fund and the fees. So you call CT this total account. If you rewrite the self-financing condition in terms of C, you see that you are adding the fees and subtracting the fees, so the fees don't show up. And you see that the strategy pi is now multiplying the total account minus the fees, because of course the manager only invests in the fund, which is C minus F. The fees, again, under the assumption that there's no interest rate and no regular fees, are proportional to this increment in the performance, in the running maximum. So if you look at the increment in the running maximum of the total account value, what you see is that this is proportional to the increment in the fund, of the any maximum of the fund. Okay. So in particular, since the total account is greater or equal than the fees alone, in other words, the fund is positive, you know that the total account is greater or equal than a fraction times the any maximum of the total account minus a constant. Now, imagine that you have a large time horizon. This guy grows exponentially. This guy grows exponentially. Essentially, this constraint is the same as a drawdown constraint. Okay? So this is just a heuristic argument which shows you why this is happening. And it shows you that this is happening because we are taking the long horizon limit. Okay? Otherwise, these two constraints, of course, are not the same. Okay, so now we have more or less the solution, and we can play with it. Play with it means that we can look at what happens to the expected utility in terms of certain equivalent rates by varying the level of the fees. Okay, so I'm not going to show you the parameter restrictions under which these two formulas hold. I'm just showing you the main formulas. And you see, for the manager, the formula is relatively simple. For the investor, this is more complicated. Here you see that the happiness of the investor depends on several things. Among them, the risk aversion of the investor, the risk aversion of the manager, and this gamma star, which is the effective risk aversion of the manager. Okay? So, what happens if we change the fees? So, the performance fees affect the manager in two ways. Of course, they make him richer, so he's happier. Okay, that's positive. That's trivial. But there is also an indirect effect. The more fees the manager collects, the slower the fund grows. The slower the fund grows, the less fees the manager will collect tomorrow. Okay? So this is negative. Which one is prevailing? Of course, you have to just check. You take the derivative. And it turns out that the negative impact prevails over the positive impact. Okay? For any parameter value. It's always negative. So this is embarrassing, of course, because it says that the manager prefers to have lower performance fees. Okay? But it makes sense if you check the assumptions of the model, because the manager prefers to have the 10% of fund which grows more rapidly than the 20% of fund which grows less rapidly. And if it takes 20%, the fund will grow less rapidly. The investor is also affected in two ways. One is that fees are cost. Okay, so that's bad news, of course, and it's trivial. The second effect is more tricky. Okay, this is so-called agency effect. So when the investor pays the fees, he is indirectly changing the portfolio of the manager. But because the manager will have an effective risk aversion, which depends on the level of the fees. So in principle, the manager could take a portfolio which is more in the interest of the investor if he's paid more fees. Right? So which way this effect goes is ambiguous. In other words, it is positive for certain parameter values, it is negative for others. So now we want to ask a ridiculous question. Okay? The ridiculous question in turn attempts to answer another question. The question is, why are hedge fund fees so high? Okay, this is a kind of a puzzle that nobody has really found a convincing explanation for. 20% plus of profits plus 2% of assets is very, very high. So let's play the following game. We let the investor choose the fees, okay, which is ridiculous because, of course, investors have no bargaining power in typical hedge fund offerings, but let's imagine that they could, okay? So Basically, we are doing an exercise in which we see if there are parameter values of risk aversion of the manager and the investor, which would lead the investor to cheerfully accept high level of fees because they are in his interest anyway. Okay? So this is what happens. It's a bit disappointing, but you know, that's what we get, and this is what we have to live with. There are only two small, there's only one small area which I'm showing for different parameter values here. On this panel, I am taking the fees, the proportional fees equal to the interest rate equal to 2%, and on this right panel, I'm taking them to be 3%. The reason why I take the fees equal to the interest rate is that it's analytically convenient and it's not that unreasonable from the practical point of view. What you see is that there is an equilibrium, a non-trivial equilibrium, that is an equilibrium where the performance fees is between 0 and 1. Other values don't make sense either for the investor or for the manager. Only if the investor has a risk aversion less than 2, which is pretty low for an investor, and if the manager has a risk aversion less than 1, which is again pretty low, even for a manager in this case. Okay. In particular, it implies that he's less risk averse than log utility. And the blue line you see here is the pairs of risk aversion for which you have that the 20%, which is typical in the industry, is in fact optimal for the investor. And you see that it is a very, very limited set of parameter values. So what is the bottom line we learn from this problem? Is that an equilibrium for these fees require very, very low risk aversion, both for the investor and the manager. For the investor, it has to be less than 2 risk aversion. For the manager, less than 1. Otherwise, there is no equilibrium. In other words, the investor would like to have fees equal to 0, but then the manager says, okay, forget it. What about the parameter restrictions? If you try to plug numbers, this is what you're getting. You're getting that our verification theorem and the constant portfolio is optimal for these levels of risk aversion. So whenever risk aversion is less than these numbers in this table, you have that the optimal portfolio, the constant portfolio is optimal, and that that is the unique optimal solution. And you see that, for example, if you take 20%, this is for fees equal to 1, this is for fees equal to 2. Whenever the risk aversion is less than, in this case, if the investment opportunities are very low, are very bad, then this is admittedly low. So the optimal solution we are presenting here may not be relevant. But if the hedge fund managers have high Sharpe ratio as they claim, let's suppose that they have at least as much as the equity market, which is 0.5, then anything, any risk aversion for the manager below 12 here will do. Here, same thing with 6.7, it's rather reasonable. If the hedge fund manager actually have high Sharpe ratio as they claim, you see that the restrictions are virtually non-existent. If you take a 1 as Sharpe ratio, here you get 27, here you get 49. So it's not really an important restriction. So, summing up, what we learn here is that if you have funds with higher fees, they should have higher leverage if the manager has more than log risk averse, and the opposite otherwise. If you have higher fees, you should observe lower drawdowns. This is what the equivalence with drawdown constraints implies, and that leverage should remain constant for a given fund over time, even if it changes across funds. So, concluding, high watermarks make managers more myopic, not necessarily more or less risk averse. They are, in some spirit, like the drawdown constraints. Okay, they have similar effects, at least for long horizons. And let's not forget that all of these results are driven by the assumption that the fees cannot be reinvested in the fund, can only be reinvested in the risk-free rate. And that's all I have to say.